This is Eco Radio KC, a locally produced exploration of positive solutions to the ecological challenges we face as we work to create a healthier future for our community and the planet.
Good evening, and thank you for tuning in to Eco Radio. On tonight's program, a recent Reuters report listed St. Joseph, Missouri, as one of the cities with a water system as bad as Flint, Michigan. So tonight we'll speak with the Ecumenical Environmental Justice Organization about that and other environmental areas of concern in St. Joseph. But first, I'm Natural Lee with your headline news. ENN.com reports new research by academics at the University of East Anglia, University of Kent, and University of Lincoln suggests that insights from behavioral science can help inform the design of road signs to bring about changes in driver behavior. Research in behavioral science has demonstrated how even very minimal cues or nudges can sometimes have a powerful influence on human behavior and decision making. In this study, the researchers apply this approach to examine whether simple visual and written cues could be used to encourage drivers to switch off their engines while waiting at railway crossings. By leaving their engines idling for long periods, drivers contribute to air pollution, waste fuel, and produce noise and fumes that harm the environment and public health. However, the researchers found that making simple changes to road signs, which prompted drivers to consciously reflect on their behavior, doubled the rate of people turning off their engines. The authors say the findings published in the journal Environment and Behavior are relevant not just for railway crossings, but anywhere with congestion. A team of researchers led by the University of Minnesota has invented a new technology to produce automobile tires from trees and grasses in a process that could shift the tire production industry towards using renewable resources found right in our backyards. Conventional car tires are viewed as environmentally unfriendly because they are predominantly made from fossil fuels. The car tires produced from biomass that includes trees and grasses would be identical to existing car tires with the same chemical makeup, color, shape, and performance. And finally, for decades, hydroelectric dams served as the United States' top source of renewable energy. But last year, wind power took the top spot, according to a new report by the American Wind Energy Association, an industry trade group. It is now the fourth largest source of energy in the U.S. behind natural gas, coal, and nuclear. Total hydroelectric generating capacity in the U.S. was 78,956 megawatts in 2015. Wind capacity reached 82,183 megawatts last year, more than triple what it was in 2008, and enough to power 24 million households, according to the report. The wind industry also supports 100,000 plus U.S. jobs, more than nuclear, natural gas, coal, or hydroelectric. At this time, I'd like to turn the show over to Mr. Richard Mabian.
Well, thank you there, Naturally. I appreciate that. Hello out there, everybody. We got a really exciting show for you tonight. Before I get started, I want to throw out a couple of shout-outs. One, for those of you who know my better half, Huskari, she had surgery last week. And I want to let everybody know that she's doing excellent. She's doing very well. She's up and about. And I have a new item to add to my resume. I now have the credentials of a head nurse. I have been very efficient in being a nurse around my house. We have a couple of friends in town, and I want to give a shout-out to them that came up from Dallas. These are our closest friends. They're like our brothers and sisters. And they here taking care of us. I mean, this Cat and Tony and Kathy was cooking today. And, boy, I mean, she can cook. Boy, I've had a great time so far. So appreciate y'all being here. And I wanted to make sure I said something about it. I got one more thing I'm going to say before I jump into the show. And this is one of those what-if kind of questions. I want to know why. And there has been no articles or comments being made about the fact that drought-ridden California is about to flood. I'm not going to say anything else about it. I'm not going to qualify me asking you that question. But I just want to know why, as an industry, if it's not advantageous to our side, we have nothing to say. Okay. Now, with that said, and maybe we'll have a show on it. You never know. That's something that if you have some issues or concerned about it, you can call and when I'm on, and we'll set up and figure out a way to make a show out of it and just have a conversation. That's how this show kind of came about. You heard naturally talking about these folks we got on tonight who we heard about. In fact, Mike heard about it, and he saw it in a Reuters article that was talking about the level of talking about. It was an investigation finds high lead poisoning rates in St. Joe. This didn't come from papers around here. This came from the Reuters paper. And Mike contacted me, I don't know, it's probably been about a couple of weeks ago, and said, hey, maybe this is something you think we want to look into this? Well, it just so happens that I have a cousin who is the lone black journalist, I think, at least it was the last time I talked to him at St. Joe newspaper. So I called him, and the thing that shocked me is he didn't know anything about it. Now, if a journalist in a town doesn't know about it, then that makes those up flags for me. Is this something that they're trying to not discuss? So then I got him. He turned me on to a young lady. In fact, she's a pastor. Now, I might probably blow this name, and God forgive me, Reverend Kaiser. It's something like that, Christy Kaiser. And I contacted her. I'm giving y'all a walkthrough of how we got where we are. I contacted her, and she just so happened to be visiting relatives in California. But she gave me the name of a young lady in St. Joe named Diane Waddell. And I got in touch with her, and she couldn't make this call because she's on her way to a environmental meeting somewhere here in Kansas City right now. But she turned me on to the two people who she felt knew the most about that, and that's who we have on the phone. We have a Shelly White and a Lisa Rock. Would you all say hello to folks out here, please?
Hi, this is Lisa Rock. Good to see you, or good to hear from you guys. Okay. And this is Shelly White.
Okay, we got both of them introduced themselves, and they are part of an organization called Ecumenical Eco Justice. So what I'm going to do is we'll start this out in a phase. The first phase, we want you to tell us about how Ecumenical Eco became a factor.
Well, you know, it started with Diane Waddell. I think there's no doubt about that. Diane Waddell has been a member of the Presbytery, and she served on the national level.
Who's speaking?
I'm sorry, this is Shelley again.
Okay, all right, got it.
And our dear friend Diane served on the national level in the Presbytery for environmental issues for many years. And so she's been quite a mentor to us in the environmental movement. But she and Krista at First Presbyterian started an ecumenical study group based on Pope Francis's Laudato Si, which was his encyclical about social and environmental justice. Now, in case you don't know what an encyclical
is. Oh, yeah. We've done a show on it. In fact, I even can say the word encyclical. that's about the closest I can get to it, but I can even do
it's
that.
Go hard. Ahead. Well, anyway, the group started studying the encyclical, which is, of course, a book.
Yes.
That went out to the bishops in the Roman Catholic Church, and it was meant to start a conversation on how the environment and social justice are really the same thing. In fact, the name of the book is On Care of Our Common Home.
Okay.
So this started a group, and, you know, the First Presbyterian sought out other downtown churches and anybody that wanted to come and be a part of this, which is how I became involved. I'm a member of the First Christian Church in downtown St. Joseph, and I started coming to it. We started that on May 15th of 2016, and we spent about three sessions once a month studying Pope Francis's book And when we got done with it, we decided that was a call to action and that we needed to become more of an advocacy group. And so we started meeting monthly to kind of look for things that we could promote Pope Francis's ideas about the environment and social justice being the same thing. So that's kind of the beginning, and we started meeting monthly, and things have come up
that's obvious because we're sitting here talking on the phone. First of all, I am a firm believer in the work that the Pope has been doing with his book. In fact, our dean of one of our colleges here, we've had him on the show, the Monsignor, and he actually got his copy of the book personally from the Pope. He went to Rome and was handed the copy, and he brought it back, and he did a show here with us, and I have a copy of it, and I really love his comments on the low income. He really was passionate and direct about the need for that portion of the population to receive some type of care and concern, and that's basically what we do. That's basically what I do. So that fit right into my world. So I'm glad to know that you all are involved. I can one of these days we'll have a conversation, and I'll tell you how I feel that what he did is very close to what the guy that I studied under did, and that was David Corton. But okay, so what when we saw that article, and I finally got to you all. And in fact, right now, I'm going to tell folks, listen, this is the first time I've heard the story. I've heard bits and pieces of it, but I told them to hold off because I didn't want to do my show on the telephone or while I was sitting out there in the green room. So I want you to bring me, just let me know which one of it is that's doing it, up to date on the lead problem that we have in St. Joe. What's going on up there?
Well, Lisa Rock here, and I'm not quite sure if on the lead problem, there may be a couple of different things going on. Recently, the Missouri American Water has been proactive. They've become proactive to go in and abate any lead that they can find in any line. And they're doing that with all of their lines. Whenever there's any kind of a dig, anytime there's a water break and they detect any lead at all, then they go ahead and abate those lines. And if they think that it's going into a home, they are now trying, they're going to start systematically going through and checking these lines, and if they find that there are lead, and the pipes aren't lead themselves, they're galvanized, but they're put together with a gooseneck of lead a lot of times. So the joint, in order to put them together, they've used lead. Now, from my understanding, the lead itself doesn't leach, you know, with the water chemicals that are used here. However, if you change those chemicals, it will leach the lead at that time, and then it becomes dangerous. And so the water company has estimated about 8,000 properties in St. Joseph, all in older districts, of course, not in any of the newer districts, but they've estimated approximately 8,000 properties that may have some kind of lead in the pipes going inlet into the properties themselves.
Okay, I got some questions for you, okay? Can you still hear me?
Yes.
Okay. One, the name of this group that's doing this abatement work is Missouri what?
It's Missouri American Water Company.
Okay, who are they?
They are the water. They provide our water service for. They are our water company here in St. Joseph.
So okay, so that's like they do the water, like a water treatment plant. They handle that kind of work.
Correct.
Okay. All right.
They actually own the system.
Okay. Well, you're saying it like they're not part of your local government, like they're an independent agency, are they?
They are independent, yes.
Oh,
but
wow.
And we buy their utility company,
okay.
Just like KCP&L or Missouri Gas Energy.
Okay.
They're a utility company, and so what we do is we buy the water from them. They do the water treatment. They do all the testing. And things like that.
Okay. Now, unfortunately, we have a multitude of folks that listening on the radio, so when I hear a word that's describing some kind of behavior, I think I like for it to be explained, so make sure people know what you're saying. What is it when they abate their lines? What is that?
To abate the lines is to go in and take that line completely out. If they are in the street and they find a lead knuckle, a lead joint in a line, then they're going to just be proactive, and they're going to take the line that goes to the house and go ahead and remove that and supply a brand new line going into the house.
Okay,
so that
they take
that
cost.
Absolutely no lead going into that property.
And the Missouri American Water Company, they absorb that cost, or do they charge?
They absorb that cost, but it will ultimately be through its service or through its customers.
Okay,
you know they will absorb probably some, but I you know like anything, it's going to ultimately. Be absorbed by the customers, I would imagine.
Okay. Now, you mentioned the joint, the lead joints. How old are these joints we're talking about?
St. Joseph got its first water in 1880.
Okay.
First water that they started running underground. It actually was ran through wood that was bound by metal, iron straps, and tarred. All the way around. That's how our original water systems were. And then as time evolved, they graduated to better materials. So in the 1800s, early 1900s, they were using lead at that time. And the lead, and when the lead becomes dangerous is when it leaches. The lead can be solid, and if you have a water that doesn't react with it, and I'm not a chemist, so, but this is what I've been explained, that if you mix a chemical in the water, you know, whatever they put in the water for treatments, the chlorines and different things, there are certain chemicals, and I don't know what those chemicals are, but they can create a leaching, and the leaching is pulling lead from the pipe, and that's when it gets into the homes and stuff and becomes dangerous.
Okay. Pulling lead from the pipes. That was going to be one of my next question. We're going to take a break here in about a minute, so hang on. I want to back up to you said that the joints are lead, but the pipes are not. What did you say the pipes are now?
The pipes are made out of galvanized steel.
Okay, so how long have those pipes been there?
Those pipes, we started getting lines in the 1880s.
So the galvanized steel's been there since 1800s too?
Well, it's probably been since the turn of the century, I would imagine.
Wow. Okay, well, we're going to take a quick break. Hang on, we'll be right back.
Okay.
I'm Kristen Schwartz.
I'm Asad Ismi.
On January 21st, up to 4 million marchers across the world declared that women's rights are human rights. Tune into Sprouts this week on your community radio station to hear part 3 of our 3-part documentary, Women, the Oppressed Majority, describing what matriarchal societies look like and what we can learn from them. That's this week on Sprouts, radio from the grassroots.
Thursday at noon, after My Place.
Hello.
This is Valerie Andrus, board president here at KKFI. I want to thank Californos in Westport and Meshuggah Bagels on West 39th Street, the businesses in our community that provide sustenance to our volunteers during our fund drive. We are all in this together. From the KKFI family to yours, thank you.
Invasive mussels muscle their way into the Great Lakes on this current cast. You might think a creature the size of a dime is no match for a freshwater system the size of Texas, but quagga mussels are prolific breeders. Multiply one by trillions, and you get mussels that can wallop even a big body of water. Native to Eastern Europe, quaggas, like their cousins the zebra mussels, barged in through the ballast water discharged from ships and were first spotted in Lake Erie in the late 80s. Quagga mussels feed year-round on plankton and other organisms, depleting food supplies for native fish, which can create a devastating domino effect in the food web. So finding a way to knock out these invaders is critical to preserving a healthy Great Lakes ecosystem. Current Cast is produced in partnership with Cornell's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future. Learn more online at currentcast.org.
All right, I'm back again, and I'm here to having a show with Shelley White and Lisa Rock. Lisa Rock, you got quite a name, Lisa. I meant to tell you that. We're talking about a discovery of some lead concerns in St. Joe. And obviously, this conversation you two are having, it's appealing to our audience. We already got a question. Someone called in with some questions. So what I'm going to do to the audience out there, I'm going to put out our studio number. So if, in fact, you want to join in this conversation, you can. The number is 816-931-5534. 816-931-5534. Now, we're not trying to put these young ladies on the spot, and we're not trying to talk to them as if they're chemical experts. What we're doing tonight is very informative information. We're finding out what's going on up the way there. The questions that the caller had, first of all, Lisa, listening to you talk, you're very knowledgeable, and I'm going to come back to find out how you have been able to gain the knowledge that you have. But they wanted to know, do you know of any independent testing that's been going on? And do you know if, in fact, anyone's been harmed by the lead?
Lisa Rock here again, and those are very good questions, but I do not have the answers to either of those. I do know that the water company automatically starts testing, and they want to they will alert the homeowners if they find any lead in the area, and they give the homeowners the opportunity. I mean, if the homeowner says, no, I don't want my pipes changed or I don't want you messing with anything, you know, they have to honor that, but they make the homeowner sign a waiver stating that they've refused it. But they haven't, I don't know of any independent testing.
Wow. So, okay, now that you said that, is there any education being done to the homeowners for them to understand what they're signing that waiver about?
They do have pamphlets in place that explain the hazards of lead, and they do try to not only verbally help the homeowner understand, but they also have readable material for them to understand, you know, so they can look it over themselves, or they can send them to a website. And I don't have the website.
Okay.
I apologize.
That's okay.
They are in the process of all of that. This is very fresh. This is very new here in St. Joseph.
Right, but that's obvious behind what was happening with my cousin. But my concern is, first of all, let's talk about you. How did you become so knowledgeable about this process?
Well, I have a in-law that works for the water company.
Okay.
And
whistleblower.
I sell real estate for a living, and my specialty are historic properties.
Okay, I got you.
And
so you have a reason professionally to be cognizant of the fact that there's something going on.
Yes.
But you also, but were you already a member of this ecumenical group when you started discovering this, or did you become a member of that group after you started discovering it?
It kind of has come hand in hand, actually. I've always been interested in the group, and but it just, they kind of both happened at the same time. One didn't provoke the other.
Okay. All right. So when I was talking to you all, you mentioned that there are various ways that the lead is a problem. Can you explain those different ways?
Yes. The one way that the lead does become very hazardous is if you change chemicals within the water. And then that's when that leaching or the drawing of lead can, you know, pull and get into the water source. And one of the big factors of that is a home water softener.
Wow.
So, and of all things, who would have thought a home water softener would be a culprit to something like that? But the softer that you make your water, the more it will leach the lead from your pipe.
Well, this is just unbelievable news, information. I've never heard anyone actually talk about that before. I mean, they're probably talking about it, but I've never heard anyone talk about it.
I don't know if there's too many people that really have or that know any better. I just happen to have been in a couple of deep conversations because of the preservation. And preservation is environmental,
right,
in many regards. It just boils down to, I'm very passionate about our historic properties that we have here in St. Joseph.
Yes.
and all the variations of them.
I've seen the work that's being done up there. I've been in the houses. The other half of my family, I'm sure y'all have known Mabians. If you haven't, they up there. There's more Mabians in St. Joe than there are in Kansas City. And so I've had a chance to be in some of those houses you're talking about. And I know about the effort that's going out to preserve and to restore, rebuild those old homes. So is that causing the lead to be an issue? Other than the fact with the soft water, how is that causing the lead to be an issue?
And there's lead in a couple of different ways in pipes. You have lead waste pipes. You know, there's a lot. You'll see a lot of lead waste lines in houses.
Okay, you got to explain that. You got to explain that. What do you mean, lead waste lines?
Waste lines are the wastewater going out that's not going to be drinkable. That's going to go into a sewer system.
Okay.
You know, you will find lead lines there. A lot, but when you get into, as far as like the drinking, most people, as of a drinking line, most people have gone to copper, PEX, PVC, but there is still galvanized in a lot of the older districts, and the older district is where the concern is. The approximate 8,000 properties is in the older districts that, you know, from 1880 to, you know, probably 1920s era.
Wow. 8,000. And this is mostly downtown, isn't it?
It is. That's our older district.
Right.
Downtown. It runs from about, if you're familiar with St. Joseph, it runs from about Mitchell, you know, north up into the north end, and then east to about 22nd Street. After 22nd Street, most of that is all suburb and newer.
Right.
In the old world, in preservation world, those are the suburbs.
Okay. So what are you doing? What does your organization do to? I am a believer in environmental literacy, of teaching people. So what is your organization doing to make people aware of the circumstance they have in the face?
Lisa Rock again here, but I think I'm going to defer that to Shelley.
Okay.
She's a little more informed on how they are doing some of those things.
Yeah, I was wondering if Shelley was going to get in this conversation. Come on, Shelley.
Very knowledgeable. Well, Shelley here. Lisa's the one that knew more about what the water company
was. Oh, yeah,
was
I understand.
Doing.
I understood that.
Before we learned about this, we had. Well, you know, we talked a little bit about how our group started. And when our group started, we have different people who are interested in different aspects of environmental justice. And we do have some people who were interested in our water quality, not just the lead, but, you know, there's some concerns. There's some other concerns for water quality. And we just have been, we just did our last meeting. Lisa talked to us about what the water company is doing. But I think that our plans going forward are that we are going to continue to have a dialogue with the water company and, you know, keep on top of what they're doing and what they're testing. And we have a few people in our organization that are interested in finding out more about informing the public about what is the quality of our water. You know, we're just new enough that we hadn't really delved into that, but it is one of our concerns that we want to be aware about what's going on in the treatment of our water and the quality of our water. And that we will be first working with the water company to understand that. And the part of the process of our group is that we take on an area that we learn about and that we have people in our group that are studying it. And then we are going to do different ways of informing the public, and that's usually starts with the churches that we're involved with. And I'm going to just give you an example of what we've done with recycling, and we will tackle water in the same way. We had the people come from the city recycling center and talk to us about what are the challenges for the city's recycling program and how it works exactly and how citizens can take part. And then we made up a flyer that we distributed to I think we have 10 to 15 churches that we are working with right now.
Okay.
To put in their Sunday bulletins to let people know this is how you recycle, how you need to collect your recycling, and, you know, what you need to do, and then a map to where the recycling center is with the hours. So I think that we'll be working along those lines as we're going to ascertain what the problems are and then do what we can do for education. But the other thing is I think that we want to start a dialogue with our public officials and the water company to really hold people, I guess you want to say accountable, that what they say they're going to do is actually being done.
You know, first of all, I'm very excited about meeting you all. Once again, let me throw this number out just in case I have anybody that would like to call. 816-931-5534. 816-931-5534. But I'm very excited about meeting you all because when I tell the story in Flint, when I talk to people about it, I tell them that, you know, I'll say something like, how many glasses of water would you have allowed your child to drink your child or grandchild to drink before you would have said, oh, no, you're not drinking any more of that water. And invariably people would say, oh, none. And then I'll go, well, what about taking baths? How many baths would you have allowed your child to drink? And they emphatically go, oh, none. And I say, well, I just want you to understand you saying that. But in Flint, parents, grandparents, brothers, sisters, cousins, relatives – allowed those babies up there to drink that water for almost 2 years. So while I know, as you just said then, you want to make sure you're dealing with these organizations for accountability, that they're doing what they said they're doing. And when they have a problem like that, they need to be held accountable, because of whether it's criminal charges or whatever. But at the same time, as you're focusing in on the powers to be, we have to find a way to reach people nowadays. See, we're dealing with circumstances that we haven't had to deal with before. Like you said, those pipes have been in the ground since 1800s, and they're starting to do things that are affecting us as people. So we have to make people understand that now it becomes their individual responsibility to be aware of what's going on around them. They have to be aware of the air they breathe. They have to be aware of the water that they drink. If it don't look right, that water in Flint was, I'm a person of color, I'm a black guy, and that water in Flint was almost the color of my palm of my hand. And people were letting their children drink it and take baths in it. I mean, come on.
Yeah.
The same thing with air. When you step outside of your house and you're feeling and you're smelling odors that sometimes make you cough, people have to become more and more aware of their environment. So that's why I'm so pleased and excited about having the chance to meet you all. And actually, you're really rookies as far as that's concerned. You haven't even been around for a year yet. And I'm excited to know that we have had a chance to stumble on each other like we have. And so we can become your voice on this end. We want to become your voice on the airways and the community radio are part of it, so that we can help you even inform people. Maybe we'll have shows like this, and your flyers will inform people that we're going to be on the show and talk about it, and maybe we'll have a call in. I'm nutty enough to figure out how we could have a town hall meeting on the radio. But those are the kind of things I think we as people need to come together and start doing and providing each other. So I'm really looking forward to that. And Lisa, I'm just totally impressed with your investigative skills. Okay, seriously, I thought you was going to say, oh, well, I work for the government, or I work for the city, and ba-da-da-da-da. You know, those people are in positions where they can hear and see things and be aware of policies and procedures. But you've done a pretty daggum good job of putting your ear to the grindstone, and I think that that's very, very special, very important.
Thank you. There's a lot, you know, we all are very passionate about where we live and what we have, and we want to keep it. We want to keep it as healthy as possible and moving forward for our next generations, you know, our upcoming generations.
Okay. One thing I wanted to explain, I know about it, but I don't know if I allowed you to explain to folks what this preservation thing that's going on in St. Joe. How that's what that is really about.
Oh gosh,
that's a long story.
we could talk for days on that one. You know, I always start out with, you know, St. Joseph. We were incorporated as a county. They're established as a county in 1839 and incorporated as a city in 1843. And we have incredibly rich history here. And unfortunately, a lot of our local people treat it like grandma's old junk. But there are a lot of us as well that are very passionate about saving it and moving forward with it. There's so many resources because of our heritage. You know, for instance, you know, our city is a CLG, a certified local government, which, you know, they gauge to get those grant monies. They gauge off how we take care of our historic properties and what we're doing with them. And there's so many other avenues to that, you know, environmental avenues. You know, the old buildings, they've stood for 100 to 150 years and can stand for another 150 years if they're renovated correctly. And it's just, it's why would you build something new? The building materials in today's standards are usually, you know, maximum of 30-year life. Okay. And but you have a historic property that has stood the test of time for 150 years and is still standing. A perfect example of that is a place we call the Cracker House, and we say that affectionately. The Cracker House is the home of Frank Summers, and Frank Summers was the inventor of the Nabisco saltine cracker. Okay. Which originated here in St. Joseph in the 1800s.
Okay, we have to take a break, so I'm going to take a break here for a couple of minutes. We'll be right back, okay? Hang on.
The second annual Kansas City Folk Festival is back Sunday, February 19th, 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. in the Westin Crown Center Hotel. This one-day, all-ages indoor event is for music lovers, families, and art appreciators looking for a summer festival vibe in the dead of winter. Supporting KKFI, Kansas City Folk Festival features an artisan market, children's programming, an Irish dance, a morning sing-along, as well as local, national, and international artists on multiple stages, including a kids' stage featuring Grammy Award-winning children's duo, the Okie Dokie Brothers, along with Kathy Fink, Marcy Markser, and KC's own Brandon Draper's Drum Safari. Tickets and information about the February 19th Kansas City Folk Festival, kcfolkfest.org.
This week on the Heartland Labor Forum, women rising up to put hatred and oppression down. We'll hear from women at the Washington, D.C. March on January 21st and find out how many people turned out in KC and why they came. Then we dig deeper into the pipeline debate with Laborers International Rep Kevin Prannis about the need to repair leaky pipes and stiffen regulations. Thursday at 6 p.m., rebroadcast Friday, 5 a.m.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. If you're trying to reduce a city's global warming pollution, take a look at the skyline, not just the traffic in the street.
In our cities, buildings account for a much larger percentage of carbon pollution, as much as 50 to 75% of citywide carbon dioxide emissions. It's a source of emissions that a lot of people don't realize.
That's Christina Angelides of the Natural Resources Defense Council. She's the director of the City Energy Project, which helps 20 cities from Atlanta to Los Angeles improve energy efficiency in buildings.
This is a growing area of interest for cities because it's so practical and common sense.
The source of wasted energy varies, but Angelides says that some of the biggest culprits are poor insulation, incandescent light bulbs, older appliances, and outdated heating and cooling systems.
So making cost-effective improvements like adding insulation, changing out lighting, can have a big impact on reducing harmful pollution in our cities.
And as an added bonus, building owners and tenants can save money on their energy bills. So as cities look for ways to reduce global warming pollution, it's vital to upgrade and modernize the spaces we live in. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
Okay, I'm back again, and we're sitting here talking to the Ecumenical Echo Group from St. Joseph, Missouri. It's been a fantastic conversation. And Lisa, I want to come back to you in just a second, but when we took a break, we got a phone call in, the same guy that called before, and Mike talked to him, and he's going to kind of give you a summary of what the guy is saying. So, Mike, would you take care of that?
Well, he really wanted to reiterate the importance of independent testing in terms of the water, and he talked about in terms of what happened in Flint. It was a college from like Virginia, I think it was, not any even from Michigan, their environmental studies department or someone, to, you know, really facilitated rigorous studies. And so he was, I guess, suggesting that might be a way of outreaching to get the studies.
Bringing the school into it. Are you hearing what he's saying there, Lisa and Shelley?
But also,
absolutely. I think that's something that as a group that we'll be looking into. Of course, when we look into following up with, we're happy that the water company is suggesting that they're going to do these things, but, you know, we'll need to be diligent on our side in holding them accountable for what they're doing. And I do think that outside testing is, you know, obviously something we should consider.
Yeah, well, I had thought about that when Lisa was talking, that everything that's going on is being done by the corporate that's responsible for it. And that's why I asked the question, were they assuming the cost for replacing those pipes? Because in a lot of situations, everything that's only thing that they're responsible for is what is in the street. So when you start leaving the street and coming into the house, that's the homeowner's responsibility.
Well, they're actually responsible for, they can be responsible for coming up to your house.
Okay. Well, you could have a different situation where you are, too. So it would be, could be different than what we're dealing with here. I was on the water task force, the storm drain task force here in Kansas City. And that was one of the concerns that I had, is because, you know, we have people who have them older homes, just like you're talking about, that have pipes that, for whatever reason, usually it has to do with roots from trees that have cracked them in the yard or something. And sure, that's not the city's responsibility.
And you, Lisa Rock here, and you are right about that. You are correct. Most times, and that's where the city, because they're aware of this, or this company, because they're aware of this, they are going to just take action on it. But they also, the next thing that they have found, these are some other extenuating factors to it, is that so many times when you go in, like Missouri American Water, if they find any lead, they're going to go ahead and replace that line coming into the house. But then they stop once they get into the house, get that main coming into the house. So, like, some of the problems that they have run across and realized is that so many people, for instance, will they ground their electrical on the old galvanized pipes. So okay, now they have realized they need to keep certified electricians on hand to be able to address those electrical issues, and they are also wanting to work with local plumbers for the interior of houses so they can inspect the interior of houses for any further potential lead, you know, once you get inside the house, for those homeowners that do want it.
Well, but yeah, I think you need to be aware of the fact that even here in Kansas City, Kansas, and Kansas City, Missouri, it became a mandate from the government that they replace the sewer drains, the storm drains in this city, in both cities, Kansas City, Kansas, and Kansas City, Missouri. So I can see how maybe some of your smaller areas are saying, let's try to see if we can get ahead of it. If we can get ahead of the problem, because they know that eventually it's going to come their way too. And so what they may be trying to do is to put up a good image of what, how they're volunteering to take care of it on their own. And in doing that, some of those problems would be possibly overlooked. That's just me speaking from my semi-radical mind. That could be happening up there. But, okay, we're getting close to my time. I wanted to say something about the preservation, the reason it was important to me. I know that it was a lot of young couples that were coming and getting those homes and going up and making that a lifestyle of doing, living in the house, fixing the houses up and the whole bit. And that's a good thing. Our young people are finding themselves in situations where they don't know, well, what am I going to do with life? And those young couples weren't millennials, so now we're dealing with millennials. And I think that it's good for those kind of situations to once again be front burner issues of something that you're trying to do in life. You know, you can get homes for ridiculously cheap prices and go in and do things to them, even though it's, like I said, it becomes a lifestyle. We're running out of time. I got a minute left here. Is there anything you would like to say? One thing from my standpoint, we have bonded and we'll start working with you and we'll make sure that we continue this conversation. Is there anything either one of you would like to say before we leave?
I'd just like to, this is Shelley again, I'd like to remind your listeners that you can know about what we're what's going on with our group on Facebook at Ecumenical Justice or Ecumenical Eco Justice, and it's in parentheses EEJ.
Okay, how are you spelling your eco? How are you spelling your eco?
ECO.
Okay, all right, we're gonna run it out of here. You give them that address again.
It's Ecumenical Eco Justice.
Okay. All right, you heard that. If you want to find out more about it, check it out on Facebook. I really appreciate both you, Sheila, and Lisa for coming in, and all the others, Diane and everyone else, who helped make this show possible. And like I said, this is really just the beginning. Thank you a lot, and we will get back to you, okay?
Thank you so much, and we'll tell Alonzo you said hello.
I appreciate that.
Yeah.
Bye now.
Bye.
Take care.
All right, everybody, this is Naturally again. I have one upcoming event for you all. It's the Best Garden Practices for Water Quality. It takes place on February 16th from 6:30 p.m. to 8 p.m. Master Gardeners of KC and an EPA biologist will host the Best Garden Practices for Water Quality and Conservation at a free presentation at 6:30 p.m. on Thursday, February 16th. John Dunn, a biologist and environmental engineer with the Environmental Protection Agency, will talk about water quality and conservation and explore the current issues of concern. He will discuss how gardeners can be good stewards and protect valuable water resources. This will take place at the Kauffman Foundation Conference Center at 4801 Rock Hill Road. You can find out more information by visiting Master Gardeners online. That's mggkc.org.
That sinking feeling in California and other stories on H2O Radio's weekly news report about water.
I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin. And it's This Week in Water.
Wind power is huge. There's no other possible conclusion to draw from data released last week that shows the capacity to generate power from wind has surpassed hydropower in the United States.
Hydroelectric dams have been the main source of renewable energy since before 1936, when Hoover Dam started operations. But the head of the American Wind Energy Association told Bloomberg that wind turbines will soon supply a tenth of the country's electricity.
And job figures in wind energy generation keep on climbing. The Department of Energy reports that a little over 100,000 people are now employed directly in wind power generation plants, as compared to only 86,000 who work in coal-fired plants.
Staying with the topic of energy, six former U.S. government officials, all Republicans, met with the Trump administration last week to express their support for a tax on carbon pollution.
The group, including former Secretary of State James Baker, are promoting what they see as free market solutions to climate change.
They propose imposing a tax on fuels like coal of $40 per ton of carbon dioxide produced. It could result in raising $200 to $300 billion a year.
And that money would in turn be paid by the government to consumers in what would be called a carbon dividend.
It's estimated that a family of four could receive a $2,000 check a year.
The plan comes as an alternative to the Obama administration's Clean Power Plan, which has attracted the wrath of Republicans.
Some critics have said that these types of proposals aren't good because they prolong the use of fossil fuels instead of rapidly switching to renewables that don't add carbon to the atmosphere.
The Army Corps of Engineers granted an easement last week for the Dakota Access Pipeline. The decision came as no surprise after the new president indicated he would instruct the permit to be issued.
In response, U.S. Army veterans are returning to Standing Rock with plans to shield Native American water protectors from attacks by militarized police, according to The Guardian.
Among the objections to the project are its potential to leak and harm water supplies of people in the area, mostly members of the Sioux tribe.
Those concerns are real. A little less than a week before the Army granted permission for the project, 600,000 gallons of oil spewed out of a pipeline about 50 miles from Dallas.
That Texas pipeline is half owned by the company known as Enbridge, And Enbridge also has an interest in the Dakota Access Pipeline, according to DSmog blog.
This latest leak is the second in this pipeline. Last October, Reuters reports that there was another problem with the same line leaking in Oklahoma.
Storms have recently been hitting the West Coast with rain and snow, leading to flooding in areas.
Much of California is finding some relief from the drought, but the rainy season is not over and there are still areas continuing to suffer.
Even as conditions on the surface improve, the overpumping of groundwater, mainly in the San Joaquin Valley, is causing land to sink in some areas and at a startling pace.
Last week, the California Department of Water Resources released a report done by NASA. The study shows that there are two main subsidence areas that create bowls where the surface is sunk.
In just 16 months, from spring 2015 to fall 2016, the ground sank nearly 2 feet near Corcoran and about 16 inches near El Nido. These aren't small sinkholes. One bowl runs for 60 miles and the other is about 25. Together they cover hundreds of square miles.
One of the major water supply lines, the California Aqueduct, has dropped more than 2 feet in parts of Kings County. The damage is causing cutbacks in the amount the aqueduct can carry south.
The director of the Department of Water Resources told the San Jose Mercury News that the current rate of ground subsidence is jeopardizing infrastructure that supplies water to the San Joaquin Valley.
The recent rains will not likely fill underground aquifers because once they sink, they collapse on top of each other, leaving no room for water to collect.
The NASA satellites that measure ground subsidence are extremely precise, and you can hear more on this subject in our interview with NASA scientist Jay Familietti at h2oradio.org.
And finally, Valentine's Day's this week, and if you don't have a date, here's a story about a guy out in the cold who took matters into his own hands, or fins, as it were.
Cichlids are rare tropical fish that live in spring-fed pools in Mexico. Their society is polygamous, so large males hoard all the females, and that makes for a lot of lonely guys.
But that didn't stop one small fish from coming up with a strategy to get the girl. Here's what he did. He hid nearby as a male and female fish were about to mate. Typically, females will deposit their eggs on rocks, and a male will follow immediately after and cover them with a cloud of sperm.
But at the crucial moment, as the female placed her eggs, the little guy burst onto the scene, dusted them with his DNA, and then dashed back to his hideaway.
The behavior is called sneaking, and it's rare, known to only occur among a few dozen species out of thousands worldwide. And it was caught on tape.
A Case Western Reserve University researcher, Ron Oldfield, had a huge tank in his office and recorded the underdog pulling off this feat.
In his video, the couple are seen attacking the interloper to drive him away, but the sneaker still managed to insert himself several times before the pair finished spawning.
And then the little guy doubled down. Not only did he interrupt the lovers, he attacked other males swimming nearby.
The video recordings are among the first of this sneaking behavior ever published about an animal. So, in case Professor Oldfield wants to make his video into a blockbuster, we think we have a catchy title.
How about Sex, Size, and Videotape?
This Week in Water is supported by the American Water Works Association. Sustainable water management means more than just conservation. Learn about water efficiency and resilience at awwa.org/sustainable.
Thanks for listening to Eco Radio KC. On 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.